One of the questions someone asked me was, how do you actually protect yourself from love bombing when it feels so good in the moment? My answer might surprise you, and I give this answer in my new Q&A video on Patreon. Recently, Patreon supporters got something that I haven't provided before, a full exclusive Q&A where I answered your most personal or your most pressing questions about coercive control, building healthy community, about the things that don't leave visible marks, but can change everything in your psyche, in your life. They are real questions with real answers. And here's the thing. That conversation is already live right now. Patreon members are listening to it. And if you're not one of them, you're missing out. So these are the conversations that don't make it into regular episodes. Those kind of nuanced questions, the specific questions, the stuff you actually want to know directly. That's what Patreon is for, among many other things. And I plan to do more of these because it was very popular. People were really wanting to ask some questions that they haven't had a chance to ask before. So if you've ever wished you could just ask me something directly, now you can. Join at the link in the show notes and you'll get access to this Q&A, plus everything else, all the bonus episodes, etc., that I'm building over there. Take good care. You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist, and I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it, that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you, without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello. Today on the show, we have Donna Lamb, really special guest, and this is the first of two episodes we're going to be doing with her. It's one of these situations where when we were done talking, we realized there's so much more to cover. So you're going to be able to actually hear from her twice, which is very exciting. Let me introduce Donna to you. Donna Lamb is a cult survivor, a writer, and former sex worker who escaped from a group called Aesthetic Realism in 2001 after being in it for 32 years. 32 years. She has been published in more than 65 community news outlets nationwide and worked as a member of the New York City Press Corps, a communications director for the members of the New York City Council, and as an administrator for the City of New York. She has also spent many years as an activist for racial justice and for the rights of people, such as immigrants and those who are unhoused or food insecure. Today, she is church warden at Holy Apostles Church in Manhattan, and for nearly 25 years has been a volunteer at its soup kitchen and also its food pantry, the largest in New York State. She lives in New York City and is completing Reeled In, a memoir about her life in aesthetic realism, her escape from it, and her recovery. You can subscribe to her free Substack, Cults Recruit People, and find out more at her website, donnalamb.com. Here is Donna now. I am very excited to be able to talk to Donna Lamb today and to have you all here a little bit about her and her story. She's going to be talking about a group that we haven't yet covered. When she mentioned the name to me about this group, it took me back to my years of doing this work in New York because I had worked with people who had been involved in this and I saw some of the after effects. So I'm so happy to be able to talk about it and what can happen to a life when it gets involved in an organization that we're going to be able to explore a little bit today. But before we get started, Donna, I would love for you to take a few moments to say something about yourself to let the listeners know who you are and what you do.
Well, first of all, of course, my name is Donna Lamb, and I'm a cult survivor, writer, and former sex worker, finishing a memoir about my 32 years in the philosophical cult Aesthetic Realism, which was founded by Eli Segal. It's still operating in downtown New York City, and I was only 21 and very vulnerable when they recruited me at a very respected acting school. Once they got me, the cult controlled every aspect of my life, including my sexuality. I escaped in my early 50s, thank goodness, and started a new life. And today, I'm the church warden at Holy Apostles Church in Manhattan and a social justice activist. I have a Substack called Cults Recruit People.
Nice, really nice. Church warden, what does that mean? Tell us.
We're sort of the governing body that the board, we're right below the clergy itself, and the governing body and the wardens are kind of the president of that board, you might say.
Okay. We're going to be talking about aesthetic realism and the organization as it is and its philosophies. And some have changed over time, some have remained the same. But it's a very curious group, unique in its way of looking at the world. And not unlike other groups, the leader felt very comfortable saying what was and what wasn't, why you have this and why you do that and what that means about you. And it was absolute, which is a really interesting thing. Very bold move to assume that you know what's true about everyone. But, you know, it's the narcissist way. I'm wondering about your life, if you can just introduce us also to you before this, because I know you had a life before you got involved. So tell us about that.
Would you like me to start with my childhood, or where would you like me to start?
Yeah. Did you grow up in New York, or where are you from?
I was born and raised in Kansas City, Missouri.
Oh.
My parents, we started out as a very poor family living in quite a rough part of the city. My father had a disability called Marfan syndrome, a genetic disorder he was born with. And so it made it very hard for him to get well-paying jobs. during the war, he was 4F and he was a supervisor at a war plant. And he came away with very glowing recommendations. But then when he would apply for jobs at auto plants, they would accept him, hire him, and then they'd give him his physical and they'd say, well, we can't have you falling dead on the factory floor. And he'd be fired. It was really brutal back then. And my mom, she'd come from a hard scrabble family, you might say, during the Depression, growing up on welfare and shamed of the poverty that she was in and things. But they were both very hard workers, very much wanting to make a better life for themselves and our family. And back then, you could get an engineering license to practice civil engineering without even going to college, as long as you were able to pass the exams. And they did that. But we went from that. We were living in a transient permanent hotel, and there was a toilet down the hallway. We didn't even have one in our own apartment, and a tub also down the hall, which I was terrified of as a little girl. And they would give me baths in the kitchen, a tub on the kitchen floor. And my mom, later years, it was so painful to even talk about that part of our life, that one time when on Thanksgiving, when they didn't even have enough money, that they were glad that us three older children didn't even know it was Thanksgiving, because all we had to eat was white bread and slop gravy. They moved us up into this teeny tiny little house. I thought we were living in the lap of luxury because we had a bathroom. By then, there were four of us children and we were all sharing the same room, bedroom. And then my parents moved up further and we moved into a nicer house. And by the time I was a teenager, they were doing pretty well. And the thing was, is that for me, one of the things about me is that when I was fairly young, I started noticing that I didn't seem to feel the same way about boys that other girls felt. I was also having attractions to other girls. And I didn't know, well, what's with that? And I thought that was all wrong, but I couldn't seem to do anything about it. One time when I was in high school, my best friend, she was staying over and we were sleeping in the guest room, where we could stay downstairs and talk all night as long as we wanted. And then I had this thought, like, wonder what would happen if I just moved over and put my arms around her and tried to kiss her. Oh, my God. See, then we're talking about the 50s and 60s in the Midwest. I never heard of homosexuality. I thought I'm the only person in the world who ever had a thought like that. And I was really quite concerned about that in myself.
Right. And you can't open up to your family. I mean, I think about all the people who are married, who had wanted to be with someone of the same gender, but there was no opportunity, but they knew they had to follow the track that they were on. And a lot of people living unhappily because of it. And it's an incredible thing, as you describe, also when you haven't heard about it, and no one even over dinner table conversation has talked about it, then you, of course, are going to think you're the only one. That's a very isolating feeling. Oh, I'm sorry you had to go through that.
Made me think there was something horribly wrong with me. And then also, one of the awful things that happened, and so many other girls too, I'm sure, have been there, were trying to prove to myself that I was straight. I dated a lot. And my senior year, I lost my virginity. And then I tried, maybe if I just sleep with this person, sleep with that guy, maybe I'll change, that something will click, something will happen. And also, I think I was trying to prove, see, I had sex with a guy, so that must mean I'm straight. So all of the unpleasant, really, sex that I didn't want to have, it was consensual, but I didn't want to have it, trying to prove I was straight was really something I look back on and think that, man, if I'd just been allowed to be who I really was from the very beginning, I would have not had to go through a lot of stuff.
Oh, yes. That can be said for so many people still all around the world. People, gay and lesbian people, trans, everywhere in between. Just anything that seems different or that somehow is prohibited or seen as a psychiatric disorder, as it used to be seen, I think, until the early 70s, which is way too late for that to be recognized the way it should be. And I know with aesthetic realism, there was a lot of issue that they had not only within the group, how they saw homosexuality, even still, I think, seeing it as a disorder way past the time, many years after the American Psychiatric Association said, no, no, it's not a disorder, but aesthetic realism wasn't convinced, which I'm sure was very hard for a lot of people. I remember, and I want to hear more about your story, but I do remember these two clients that I worked with, one woman, another a man, and the man had gotten involved because he wanted to find a way to not be gay, and he was sure it would cure him. And then he became suicidal and decided to leave when someone really rescued him from it and said, this is going to slowly kill you. A woman who was sure that she was hostile and that she had something wrong with her and that she had to always be working on herself and she was never done. She just came into my office, I remember, when I was in Manhattan, and she said, when am I ever going to be healthy? And I said, what makes you think you're not? And she said, what? It was sort of not even an option that you could be okay, actually, and that you were maybe already okay. But I think for someone like Eli and anyone who came after him to feel necessary, they have to make sure you have enough problems to need them. And that is a very interesting and trippy way of living a life.
Oh my gosh, you hit the nail right on the head, because the whole thing was, is aesthetic realism kept convincing you, you are a terrible person. You have too much contempt. You this, that, and something else. Everything's wrong with you. And the only way you're ever going to get better is keep studying aesthetic realism. And that is exactly what they did. We had ways that if a person was not changing from homosexuality like they were supposed to, then we would push them out. The fact is that I'm a victim of conversion therapy. I supposedly changed, with the accent on supposedly. Also, Eli Segal designated me a consultant, aka a teacher of aesthetic realism, to teach other women to supposedly change from lesbianism. The whole thing is that you needed to be like a walking advertisement for aesthetic realism in all fields, and certainly for the change from homosexuality. And if a person wasn't changing, then we might give them an assignment that was just impossible to complete. And it was a long-range, ongoing assignment with lots of research. It was the assignment that they keep turning in, and it's not good enough, not good enough. You can't have consultations anymore. Until we would finally drive them away, and we'd make them think it was their fault, not that we had kicked them out.
And that is always the way it is. In all of these groups, everything is your fault. You need to take responsibility for everything. Even if you get sick, if you get injured, if something happens to you, you made it happen. You, I don't know, in Scientology, you pull it in. There are a lot of things that happen that are set up, I think, in these groups so that you will constantly point the finger inward and be introspective. And then be open to the idea that you need help, that you need to take courses, that you need to come back for more, that you're not done yet. It is dangling this impossible carrot also, like you're saying. But to go back in time with the life that you were living, with your upbringing, and thank you for painting that picture for us about living the way you were living. And I think all of this is going to lead you to wanting to know how you can have a good life, maybe an easier life, get the answers to questions, have maybe a sense of security. There are a lot of things that our childhoods lead us to feeling like we need, but I'm curious what you were looking for and how you found this group.
There's kind of two different tracks. First of all, as you know, aesthetic realism is a very intellectual cult. There's no chanting and dancing around and getting happy in aesthetic realism, I can assure you. And there is a certain type of very scholarly person. And from when I was very little, and my whole family had very scholarly interests and artistic interests, and I developed very early an interest in acting, singing, and dancing. I wanted to be a triple threat. I wanted to be an actress. I wanted to make it to Broadway. That was one of my earlier dreams. But also from when I was very little, I just wanted to understand, why is the world the way it is? Why am I the way I am? What's up with my parents? There were just so many things, as you're saying, I wanted to know. For instance, one of the things very early, I loved music. It's like, why is it a piece of music can be so beautiful, it hurts? And how come there can be Danny Boy? It just makes me feel terrible, but I just want to listen to it over and over. And so I had questions like that, and I couldn't wait to go to school. I thought they're going to explain everything. Well, guess what? They weren't going to explain everything. So I began to see that I'm not going to find it here. And then I thought, well, maybe the teachers have some special knowledge. And then one time, I think I was in fourth grade, where my mother came to school and she's talking to my teacher in the hallway. For some reason, I'm watching him and the sun is streaming in. And then it's like, wait a minute, I don't think adults know anything more than I do. This teacher was always kind of jittery and nervous, kind of like a little sparrow hopping around. I would think, I thought, she's as confused as I am. That's why she's always so nervous. And it's like, who do you even look for in this world for answers? In terms of the acting, I ended up coming to New York and going to acting school. That was what I wanted. That was where I came across aesthetic realism.
What acting school were you in?
I went to HB Studio. Also, what happened is that I'm just kind of intertwining my life before, you know, and how I met it here. But when I was in high school, I was fortunate enough to get parts in a couple of plays at the Kansas City Circle Theater. One was The Streets of New York, a musical melodrama, and the other was Where's Charlie? I was in the chorus and the understudy for Amy, and that really cemented it. Now, my father, he was dead set, like a lot of parents. No, no, I will pay for you to go to college to study engineering or business administration, where you will always be able to make a good living, but not pay for you to be an actress and go somewhere and starve. I did go to 1 year of college, and then I got some parts there, and that cemented like, yes, I'm going to go for this thing. And even though I'm going to have to be on my own, I'm not going to have any money. So I've basically been self-supporting since I was 18. I did a summer of summer stock, and then after that year of college, and then came straight to New York and started getting into some trouble.
Okay, let's talk about the trouble. But I also want to mention Kansas City has a big arts district. It's very interesting. I don't know if a lot of people know that it's a hub for a lot of really talented people. I think it's the Crossroads Arts District. I remember hearing about it. So if anyone is there, check it out. So you went to New York and you got into trouble. That definitely feels like a lead in to a story. So go ahead.
Yes. Well, what happened? I show up in New York, and throughout it, the motif playing in the background of everything is that I'm still gay. You know, I'm still struggling with my sexuality. And I show up in New York City and I have this dream of studying acting, but I didn't have much money. I had hardly any money, no skills that were really going to enable me to get really well-paying jobs. So I did some nude modeling, like at School of Visual Arts and other places. And the first thing was, the second day I was in New York City, I went to the bank to cash some traveler's checks. And it was one of these old banks, beautiful, you know, with the marble and everything. A man is standing behind me. By then, by the way, I'd become a hippie. That had happened at college and when I dropped out to save some money, and I was living in a hippie commune. So he's looking at, I think, my hippie vibe, and he strikes up a conversation and, oh, are you here to tour us? You look like a free spirit. And I said, well, no, I'm actually just moved here and I need to find a job. And he said, well, I know a place you could earn some good money today. Nice and safe, no exploitation. And I said, really? What? And he said, well, it would be servicing some men in the Diamond District. And I said, you mean having sex? And he said, yeah, but it's safe and they're good people. And I'm like, whoa, I was not expecting this. And so I stand off to the side while he goes and does his thing. And I'm thinking, well, all that sex I gave away for free in college that was meaningless and I felt cheap and dirty and disgusted by the whole thing, would sex for money be that different from everything I've already done? And I really need the money. And so when he came back, I said, I'll do it. So he walked me over to the Diamond District, left me at a place, and he went. I never saw him again, but I saw, that was the first time I saw several men, and I was really quite shocked, you can imagine. I wasn't just like casual for me, but they were like, hey, this is nothing out of the ordinary here. They were just like, it was the most normal thing in the world, which also did help me get through it. I walked out and I'm like, what have I done? Oh my God, what's happened here? And then it's like, but then I reached in my purse, well, these $200 in my purse certainly feel good. And then is this just my Midwestern straight-laced background trying to get into my head? It's my body and I can do what I want. So I'm trying to justify it. So the whole question of how to make money to get to acting school was a problem.
Right. As you're talking, I'm thinking about how many conversations you had in your head. I'm sure volumes and volumes of conversations where you needed to figure things out on your own, like thinking about, well, I have a friend who's right next to me. If I put my arm around her and kiss her, then what would happen? Just those conversations, and then making decisions, and this moment of great conflict, because there are a lot of decisions that are born out of need that are not the decision you would have made otherwise. And it feels sometimes like it's the only choice or viable choice. And you might not know, or you might not let it register, because you can't let it register how much it's wearing you down or affecting you, because you need it. There's almost like a dissociation that comes into play to protect people from the impact that something's happening until that stops working. And then a change needs to be made. Yeah, I'm wondering if that's what happened for you.
I think so. And it continued, because then I really seriously tried to find work. And it was all like in the service industry or selling magazines over the phone, you know, all these things. And sometimes I would go to interviews that would seem to be about one thing, but then it would turn out to be about something else. And I didn't take any of them. And as I said, I was a nude model at art schools. And then I there for a very short time, one of these disgusting places on 42nd Street, even that was just beyond the pale. It was so disgusting. I just couldn't do it. Then I was making a soft porn movie back in 1967 or 8 now, and more like what you'd see on cable TV now. So when I was doing one, in between the shots, there was another beautiful woman that just, we were waiting, sitting on the same bench, and we started a conversation, and I said, so do you want to be an actress too? And she said, oh, hell no. I'm just here to make some money to have something to declare on my taxes. And she said, I'd do something much better. I'm a call girl. I make a lot more money, a lot faster than doing this stuff. Then she says, you look like a smart girl. Maybe you'd like to consider it too. Come and see me sometime. And you want to be an actress? And I said, yes. And she said, well, really, being a call girl is a form of being an actress, only without any camera or audience there. You're just going to act. You're going to become the person that your client's paying you to be. So it's not that different. And so I went away, and I'm thinking, the way things are going, it's going to be decades before I can afford to go to acting school. So let me consider it. She'd given me her phone number, and I called her. We made an appointment, and I went, she had a place up near Columbus Circle. And I go up, and on her floor, I'm stepping out, and there's this very well-dressed, dapper-looking black man stepping into the elevator, and he certainly gives me a good look at me as the elevator doors are even closing, and I go have a conversation with her. And guess what? That man happened to be her pimp, Ronnie, and within about an hour, he was my pimp too.
Okay. I think about when I talk to people who got involved in things later on, not people who were born and raised in groups, but ones, someone approached them on the street or they struck up a conversation. And these moments, these watershed moments, when you're really searching, when you are feeling like you don't have options and you really need to be able to eat and have heat during the winter, if you can afford it or whatever else you might need, they will lead you into or onto a certain path in your life. And I'm thinking of all the people who have been guided into cultic groups and who have been guided into doing a lot of things that they weren't ever planning to do. Similarly, where someone might come up to you and say, oh, you know, I help people get a scholarship to acting programs. That could have happened too. It would be much more rare, but then you would have been on that track. But here you just kept getting offered sex work and staying in that realm, because it seems like that was for so many women and also men. Those are the choices that are more plentiful. It really shouldn't be that way, but I know it is. So here you are with a pimp. That was not what you'd signed up for when you moved to New York. And so what happened next?
I was really lucky because he turned out to be not really a terrible person. And when you're talking about people not having choices, one of the things that I saw being in the life, as it's called, getting to know other working girls, other sex workers, and other pimps and all kinds of people, that just about everybody, they felt like they didn't have any other choices. And that's the thing that I wish people would understand more. He really took me in hand and taught me the tricks of the trade, so to speak. And one of the things that really affected me very much for the rest of my life, too, and my social justice activism later on, I think, was partially informed by this, that one of the first things he said to me is that you need to realize that the color of your skin is worth money. Your white skin is worth money. Michaela, as I call her in my book, the other girl, he says, she's drop-dead gorgeous. Everybody can tell she's Latino, so she can't charge as much as you're going to be able to charge because you're white. And also that in order to make as much money as you can make seeing a client, a Black woman would have to do much more kinky things. You won't have to do hardly anything to make the big bucks. Plus, you can go to the places where the highest paying Johns are up in the Upper West Side, Upper East Side, and the hotels are never going to think anything of you being there. You can go to condos and just everywhere, you know, and you'll fit right in because of the color of your skin. So that was one of the first things. And then I never worked the street. It was strictly, when we say call girl, that's what it was, at my place, his place, or a nice hotel. But Ronnie helped me select furniture shopping with your pimp, buy a lime green fluorescent chair for the living room and my red paisley bedspread and everything, kind of to give off the hippie vibe, but really it still had to be pretty much not too much personality so people could make me into who they wanted me to be. And he had a list, he had the names of a lot of men who frequented working girls, and that was who I would be calling. And he taught me things like, for instance, always start out sounding very professional, businesslike, because it's supposed to be the phone number, his private number at work. But if, God forbid, it happens to be his home number or something, you could really lose him and all of his contacts, other people he'd be referring. So you always like, hello, is Albert there, please? And then once you know that you've got the right person, then it turns into, well, hello, honey. I'm just this sweet young thing up from the Midwest looking to have a good time here in the Big Apple. You want to join me? When Robbie first told me, I just thought, oh my God, that is too stupid. Well, you cannot imagine how well that went. And pretty soon I had all the clients I could possibly want. I was seeing 5 or 6 men a day.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Okay. So it's very interesting. All of that is so interesting about the white privilege and about the acting and about really learning how susceptible people are to a certain presentation, which makes me think about cults also. And so let's move into how you found aesthetic realism and when that began.
What happened was that Michaela came to me one day very suddenly and unexpectedly and very agitated. And she said that actually Ronnie and I are married, and so you can go. You're now free. I was shocked because, you know, I'd never had any problem with that, but apparently a pimp is not supposed to show any favoritism. So then I was out on my own without him. He'd trained me, and I had lots of contacts with other pimps to trade people back and forth, the clients back and forth, and take our cuts. So pretty soon I was making really good money, and I could afford acting school. And so for the first time I started, I did get into acting school and was doing all kinds of scenes and seeing clients and practicing and rehearsing and doing everything. I hated the work, but I was doing it. And then what happened, though, is that speaking about what you were saying about people being forced into it, this one particular pimp told me one day that he had this girl just up from Atlanta, and she was 17, which I don't know if is really true, but she really looked like she was only 13 or 14. So if I had any use for her, I felt like, no, there's no way I'm going to ever use a person that's possibly underage. But then when I met her, I saw how sweet she was, and the glow was still in her eyes. And I just thought, no, I got to help her get out. And to make a long story short, I did get her out. I don't know if she stayed out. I never know, but I helped her get out of that life. So then I went one time to get the money. I thought that he didn't know that it was me that did it. So I went to pick up the money one time that he owed me. I was a little nervous, but he lets me in very politely. But then at a certain point, he goes over and he gets this great big chain, doubled up chain, and he's coming at me. Where's Bonnie? What did you do with Bonnie? And I thought he was going to kill me. And he's really threatening me, and he's waving it around and inches from my face, and we're screaming at each other. And I probably looked green, white, thought I was going to throw up or have diarrhea. I just said, I took something to try to abort. I'm pregnant. He just kind of like stopped dead in his tracks and just stared. I said, I have to go into the bathroom. And he let me. And then when I came back out, he was just like a different person, just like deflated. And he let me out. And I walked down from his place in the 80s to mine in the 30s along Park Avenue. And I just like, oh my God, I'm seeing this world. I never saw the world look so beautiful lit up in the street lights, the buildings, and the world I never thought I was going to see again. And after that, something in me just changed. And I just felt like I couldn't go on anymore with any of this. And I did, it did lead to my getting out of that work because I felt like this is not going to go well. And then I really went down the tubes at that point with drugs. I was depressed and I had to drop out of acting school, you know, to go to acting school and take criticism and everything. But I did start auditioning for plays and I got a part in touring company of Tobacco Road. I went on tour. I was trying to lift myself back up somehow, find something to get my life back on track. And that's where I call her Terry in my book. I met and fell in love with a woman.
Nice.
So thrilled because it's not that there's something wrong with me and I'm incapable of love. It's that I'm a lesbian. That's it. And so then I came back to New York, but it was hard with the long distance relationship to try to kind of move it ahead, you know, my story ahead a little bit. I did end up going back to acting school. I still thought that the drugs was just too much, and also the anger I was feeling at men. And I was even having hallucinations with my drug-addled mind of shooting men point blank on the street and watching them crumble. And that terrified me because I didn't want to have these thoughts and I couldn't make them go away. And I thought, well, if I go back to acting school, that's the best thing that represents me, I think, my love of the arts. And so I enrolled at HB Studio again in a musical comedy class taught by Anne Fielding, who was an aesthetic realist.
Right. Wow. I think about the fact that you finally were able to fall in love and say, this is me. And now when people are able to be more freely themselves at a younger age, they don't need to go through all the things that you went through. And I feel for the people still being raised in environments, in households, in religious organizations, in countries where this is not at all allowed. And so they're still going to be going through so much akin to what you went through. I also understand the notion and the hallucinatory fantasy of shooting men, because there's an interesting thing that happens when you talk to people in therapy. Fantasies are okay. Acting on it is not. But fantasies let you know and let us know about where the emotion really is, like the depth of the emotion. And I think when you're talking about doing something so that a man crumbles, I think it's about getting your power back, making sure that they don't have the power to stop you. I think also men, not as you might view men now, but then leading up to that point, the way they had been in your life, which is not the way all men would have been. These are men who would have used these services. They were a symbol of your oppression, of you really being in this kind of bondage and a life that you felt like you couldn't get out of. And so people do sometimes fantasize a way to get free. And if they feel like they might not have enough physical strength of their own, they will often fantasize about using something. And it could be a gun, it could be bow and arrow, it could be hiring somebody to do it. So it all fits with how you were feeling. And I think really wanting to say, wait, hold on, I don't want to have to deal with that kind of oppression and being stopped anymore, having someone stand in my way. I want to be able to be me. I find it so interesting also that then this person who was teaching your acting class was connected to aesthetic realism. There are actually a number of people I know who have gotten involved in their cultic groups through acting programs, or that the acting program itself was run like a cult, which we've actually covered on this podcast before, but I have clients all the time who come and talk to me about that. So sometimes it's ripe for this kind of personality. Now, going back to your story. So here you were in this acting class with Anne, and what happened?
Well, Anne Fielding was really an excellent teacher. I will say that for her. And see, I go in and I had to audition for it, for the class, and I didn't know that aesthetic realism was the teaching method or anything, but then her class, one of the principles it was based on is of aesthetic realism is all beauty is a making one of opposites, and the making one of opposites is what we're going after in ourselves. And so I had brought this song, 80 Annie's I Can't Say No from Oklahoma. I did it with an interesting choice, huh?
Very interesting. I like it. Yes, meaningful.
I did it with all the usual showbiz glitz, you know, and everything. After I performed it, she said, so what opposites do you think you saw? And I'm like, I don't know. And so she said, well, what about the opposites of superficiality and depth, hidden and shown? And also two of the opposites that are pivotal in good acting, where you wield together sincerity and insincerity. I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. That was only the beginning, because then she asked me, well, do you think that it's better to keep your real self just for yourself and manufacture something other, some picture of yourself to show other people that you think they want? And I was like, oh my God, that is it. She really got it. And because I thought I was so deep and complex that no other people could possibly understand me. Besides, people didn't really want to understand each other. And so it was just better to keep me hidden and just put forth this bimbo type girl, you know, who doesn't really like to think too much. I had a very sweet face, sweet voice, dyed long blonde hair, you know, and all. But then inwardly, I felt like, man, they're such fools. And I'm ridiculing people in my mind. I felt totally exposed, like naked before the room full of people. And part of me is saying, I'm going to run out of here and never set foot on a stage again as long as I live. Oh, my God. The other part of me that was desperate to become a better actress and a better human being, I was drinking in every word because I really wanted to improve myself. Ask me if I'd like to do it again. And I said, yes. And so I did the song again. This time I tried to take off all the things she said I'd pasted on and just really get to what could the words in the song mean to me sincerely and do it that way. And it was so much better. And all of the class, they clapped. It was a great improvement. And walking home afterwards, I just thought, man, maybe there really is something to this aesthetic realism. I don't really understand what it is. But maybe this thing really is what I'm looking for to help me fix my life.
Yeah, maybe. Was she recruiting other people into it too?
She was trying to recruit the entire class. she was constantly inviting us to programs. Every Saturday night, there was a public program on aesthetic realism. And I don't know how many other people took her up on it, but I, after a little while, I thought, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to check it out. I thought that it was going to be a lot of people in the arts and colorfully dressed people. And I put on this psychedelic looking jumpsuit and I go down there and it's like, I walk in and everybody's in business attire, the women in these modest little dresses and the men in the suit and tie and everything. And I just felt like, oh my God, I mean, I look more like I might be a cult member than any of them did. I sit down and I listen to the first half of the program and it just went right over my head. It's like, what is this? And it was so erudite. And also, nobody was speaking. They were all just reading from Eli Segal's teachings. They were, I think, trying not to show any of their personality to intrude on his words. So it was kind of everybody sounded alike and sing-song. For instance, one of the things, I can give you a sample.
Yes, please. Oh, I love that.
I don't know if you know, but Self and World, the book Self and World is sort of like the aesthetic realism equivalent of the Bible.
Okay.
One of the things that Segal wrote was, there is a deep and dialectic duality facing every human being, which can be put this way. How is he to be entirely himself and yet be fair to that world which he does not see as himself? The definition of aesthetics is to be found in a proper appreciation of this duality. So that's the kind of thing I heard. Really, what it boils down to is we're all trying to figure out how to be good to ourselves and fair to other people, just like a mother is trying to carve out a little time for herself while also being a good mother taking care of the kids. But everything was made so complicated, you know. Oh my gosh, I couldn't wait for intermission to come. And so I'm standing there trying to look casual and relaxed, leaning against the counter, looking around, and I'm just a ball of anxiety and uncertainty and confusion about my own life. And I look at them and it's like, oh my God, they look so confident and so sure of themselves and like they know exactly what they're doing with their life and at ease. I want some of that. And that was what brought me back again and again.
It's so interesting. The things that you've mentioned so far are things that happen nearly all the time of the stories that I hear. First, that you look around and you have an impression that everyone else has it together. They're probably doing the same thing and looking around and saying, look how everyone seems to have it together. I wish I did. I don't understand what's going on, but I know I need to kind of act like I do. So a lot of people are acting in a lot of these groups and they're trying to get by. They're trying to not seem like the only person in the room who doesn't get it, who doesn't have it together. I think people are feeding off of the way people are wanting to present themselves. So interesting how much acting is a part of that. What's also interesting is the idea that the wording itself is hard to understand, which also almost always happens, that people need to really study and in order to really get an understanding, and that at some point you either get an understanding or you don't, but you seem like you do, or you beat yourself up and say, what's wrong with me that I don't understand it? And then at some point too, it could be that it doesn't make sense. But that's not a possibility to have as one of the like multiple choices. Well, maybe it doesn't make sense. And maybe the person who wrote this might not be well or is trying actually to kind of be confusing in order to make people think that they're of a higher level intellect. It reminds me of going into museums and sometimes you see the little plaque next to a piece of art and it talks all about the piece of art and you're thinking, what? What was all that? Just tell me. Just say it. Just say it in words that people understand. But I think people are posturing to want to seem like erudite, like you were just saying, but of a higher intellect. There's so much at play here that is so interesting that you walked into that can make you feel like you're saying, oh, I think I need to keep coming back for this because there's something here and I want to get it and I want to feel like them and I want to understand. But it could be that it really might not make sense. So you then came back. Tell us just overall what your experiences were like.
Well, as I'm sure you can imagine, there was love bombing going on. Suddenly everybody wanted to be my friend and everything. And one of the things was, is that back then in 1969, the aesthetic realists weren't yet talking about changing homosexuality. That didn't start until 1971. But I wasn't telling anybody, I'm in love with a woman, I've got a girlfriend, because I wasn't sure what would happen. And so I did kind of float a question about, I tried to indirectly ask, and the answer was that Eli Segal said you can have sex with an elephant as long as you have goodwill.
Interesting response. Mm-hmm.
Well, I thought, damn, he's even more liberated than I am. And I thought, without my asking, they're probably accepting of homosexuality. And at first I thought, well, if they're against my being lesbian, this is not the place for me. And then later on, I also thought, naive as I was, that I thought, well, I can just show them that they're wrong. Yeah, right. So I started coming. And I also think that even when there were any kind of warning signs, like Ann Fielding fairly shortly thereafter announced that her husband was giving a paper on the Saturday night program about how he had changed from homosexuality in 1946.
That's right. I remember that about her husband. Yes.
Sheldon Kranz.
Right.
I mean, some of us in the class were looking like, do you really believe this? And skeptical, but I thought, hey, I'll go and see what he has to say for himself. And I thought, oh, he can't really be gay the way I'm gay. And maybe he was experimenting and it went wrong or something. So I go, as soon as I saw him, it's like, that guy did not change. That guy is gay. If I'd just seen him around in the village. And then I listened, and it was a very deep talk about his mother and everything that had happened and aesthetic realism, just like everything else, like your recent one with Dr. Lucas Wilson. It's always the mother. The mother is blamed. Aesthetic realism was just like all of them. But he talked about all of this, and he also talked about his self-hatred and what he went through interiorly. And I did feel like, geez, I'm seeing something about the depth of a man I've never seen before, and maybe this is helpful. I came away feeling like, as I say, I think this guy is still gay. But I wanted so much for aesthetic realism to be what was going to fix me that I just flew by some of the things that I should have said, I'm getting out of here right now. But I just kept coming back and started studying everything, the literature and having conversations. And of course, the people were thrilled to have somebody like me that just like open ears, just very eager to hear everything that you have to say. We'd go out for coffee and I'd be taking notes. I was so thirsty for information. And then that's how it kind of all got started. And then what happened with my girlfriend was that she decided that she just couldn't go on, that better to end it now because the long distance thing just wasn't going to work for her. And she hated New York. And I, of course, if I wanted to go into theater, I couldn't move to her city either. So I begged and pleaded, we can spend more money, we can come back and forth. And it's like, no, neither of us can afford that. So that was the end. And basically, later on, I kind of realized that really what happened was that on the rebound, well, I can't have Terry in my life, that I'm going to throw myself into the arms of aesthetic realism. And I took out a study form, as it was called, to study directly with Eli Segal. And what that entailed was saying in my own words that I thought he was the greatest human being who'd ever lived, and that aesthetic realism was the knowledge that all humanity had been waiting for, and that I wanted to use the rest of my life studying aesthetic realism and working to have it known to the world. That's what I did.
Wow, incredible. And how long were you involved again? I know you mentioned at the beginning, but what was the amount of time?
I was in it for 32 years.
Oh my goodness.
It's mind-boggling.
Right. Well, I think you have to be getting something from it, and it could be what you're needing, or it could be community, or like you're saying, throwing yourself into the arms of something. You want it to become your everything. I'm wondering then what caused you to break away from it?
Well, it was way down the road, needless to say. But for many, many years, even though the way aesthetic realism operated there were a lot of things that I objected to, the utter total control over our lives and including our sexuality. But I did still believe in the teachings of aesthetic realism, that I believed I was in on the ground floor of something that was going to change the world. And that was something that from when I was a very little girl, I wanted to become a good person and I wanted to do good for humanity. Just like the stories mom would read us at bedtime, you know, some of the heroic deeds people could do. So there was always that. I thought that with everything, aesthetic realism is going to change the world for the better. But then in 1996, by then Eli Segal had taken his own life in 1978, and his successor started something, a campaign to have aesthetic realism known where we would become the press. That the boycott of aesthetic realism, you know, that press and media, they know, they see Eli Segal's grandeur and their petty little egos can't bear it. And they know they need to learn from him. So they're never going to be fair to Eli Segal and aesthetic realism. So we are going to be the press. I started writing articles and getting them published. And the thing was, is the articles, it was to pretend like you really cared about the issue. It was really just a puff piece for aesthetic realism. And I call it bait and switch, you know, where the hook, like the economic problem in Columbia, Missouri, where I'd gone to college. Now, switch right fast to how Eli Segal and aesthetic realism have the answer. So they're the real star. I was doing that. And then I started thinking, well, I would really like to write about racism. Growing up in Missouri back then and seeing what I'd seen, if I can just drop back to my early childhood again for a minute. When my parents were working there, we had a Black woman who was taking care of us. Blanche Thomas was her name, wonderful person. My mom always tried to teach us not to be racist, and we were told, if you ever use the N-word, we will wash your mouth out with soap and give you a thrashing. And we were also never supposed to let on that we noticed that anybody was a different skin color, be colorblind. But one time my curiosity got the best of me and I asked Blanche, do you ever wish you were white too? And such a look of sorrow came over her face. And she said, why would you even think that way, child? Why would you ask that? And I saw that I'd really upset her and I didn't understand why. And I wish like anything I hadn't asked that question. And then it was many years later that I understood that I had in essence just said that I already know that white is seen as being better than being Black in this world here. That's an advantage. That and many other things that I saw in Kansas City. And then also, as I say, when I was a sex worker, I really had a feeling about wanting to end racism. I really felt it. And I did at first really believe that Eli Segal had the answer to how that could be. Because he said that racism didn't begin with race. It began with the desire to have contempt, the dislike of the difference of the world. Basically, the thing was, is that people needed to study aesthetic realism and to learn how to oppose their contempt, and racism would end. So I did buy into that for a while.
Okay, that's very interesting, because he talks a lot about contempt. I remember now I'm remembering one of my clients saying that she's afraid of saying that she's bored because that's contempt for the world. That's so interesting. It kind of gives me a little bit of insight into Eli's mind. Anger and contempt seem to be on his mind a lot, and it was the reason for things. And I'm not sure how it makes sense in a lot of these equations. I also, now going back to your childhood, I love that your mom read you books about heroes, the heroes in the world, the people who were strong, the people who overcame things, the people who protected people. I mean, that is so wonderful. Also, with living the very difficult life that she had, she still was focused on the heroes, the strong ones, the ones who make a difference. That's quite fantastic. And to be raised with that is really important. You thought that Eli was going to have the answer to that. What happened? What did you find?
What happened was some things started happening, and I felt like this will never do. This is really namby-pamby. But first, if I could just say, yes, you're right about aesthetic realism was very focused on contempt and criticizing. Criticism is love, and the thing we're criticizing is contempt. And that by far outshadowed other things aesthetic realism was supposedly about, the outward facing, the deepest desire of every person is to like the world and the need to see the opposites. And the third thing, needing to oppose our contempt, because that stood in the way of our desire to like the world. But what happened specifically with this, you may remember James Byrd Jr. when he was literally lynched in East Texas.
Yes.
By three white supremacists who dragged his body 3 miles along an asphalt road. And it was a lynching. I remember when I heard about that, it literally, like, my legs went weak. I had to sit down. It was just so horrible. I felt like I was going to vomit. I don't even want to tell the details. And for the first time, that made me think, aesthetic realism doesn't have the answers. That is like waving a white hanky to stop a Mack truck. Something that is that entrenched and that violent could happen. And that was just that first realization that maybe the principles of aesthetic realism aren't all that. The best way I could describe it, it was like the first rumblings of an earthquake is about to happen and literally tear my whole world down around my ears. Everything that I had staked my life on, everything I believed in, was going to be rubble with me standing in it. And it was the first inkling that maybe this isn't everything as good as I thought it was.
And it doesn't have the power to make the changes that need to be made and to stop the pain that is out there, to really make a difference, that maybe it's a lot of words. And it sounds like you wanted action and you wanted to take action.
That's exactly right. I wanted to take action, and that got more and more intense. The next thing that happened, where it almost showed my real self is trying to get its nose up above to the surface, was when I was asked by a Black newspaper also in Texas, San Antonio, to write a weekly column on aesthetic realism for it. And so I wanted to write an article to celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday that year. So I already knew enough that I was supposed to write about Martin Luther King like he's just merely standing in the shadow of Eli Segal, a much lesser man who needs desperately to learn from Eli Segal. But I could not force myself to write that article like that. And I wrote it the way I thought was fair and true. Oh my God, the world of hurt that came down. And interestingly enough, the main student body saw it. They loved it. They liked it and sent it out to a lot of papers. It was one of the most widely published articles in all of aesthetic realism, perhaps. But when Eli Segal's designated successor saw it, she hated it. And that I had put Eli Segal's greatness on Martin Luther King. And I was just ripped limb from limb. I felt like just from that alone, I had PTSD. And it took me more than a decade before I could even hear the name Martin Luther King without just my stomach dropping into my toes, that the punishment I got for that was so extreme. But the fact that it really was the first sign of any kind of a defiance that I'm going to defy this thing.
Right. There are people, when I ask them sometimes, what was the tipping point for you when you left that kind of relationship that you were in or that kind of group that you were in? Sometimes it is something that connects with their moral center. And it is something like this, like, I'm not willing to put someone above Martin Luther King just because their ego needs it. I'm not going to do that. It feels wrong, and it is wrong. Similar to when people see other people being abused or something happening to a child in a group, like that was the point, the bridge too far, the point of no return. And so it's very interesting that your conscience, that your want to do the right thing and show the world what's accurate, but also celebrate the heroes. I'm thinking back to your mom's stories. Nothing should get in the way of being able to really celebrate what they've done and what they do. That's really interesting. And I'm so sorry they tore into you. But yes, that is also, if I can say, the narcissistic way. There is nothing that I think hurts a narcissist more than the shame of not mattering as much as somebody else or not more than somebody else. And so here you reminded them of the hierarchy, the accurate hierarchy, but they didn't want to see it.
Eli Segal always had to be the smartest person in the room from when he was a child onward, and he didn't work well with others, you know, that he had to be the unparalleled greatness person. And then you also mentioned about my desire for activism, because that was kind of the next thing. Because now you also may remember the murder by four policemen. They didn't call it murder. The shooting by four undercover cops of the African immigrant Amadou Diallo.
Oh, my goodness.
41 bullets.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
And here I am, a person of conscience, just wanting to be a decent human being, and also writing for a Black newspaper. How could I not take a stand against this, write something? But the current leader then, no, we were not allowed to criticize anything that the police department, because that could jeopardize the foundation's tax exemption. So we were all supposed to remain silent and not do anything. So I ask, since the entire nation, every publication, every news outlet in the nation is writing and talking about this, can't I have an exemption to be able to write about it? I got raked over the coals for even daring to ask. What I did was I started secretly and pretty much disguised going out and going to protests and things, because I'm going to do something. I mobilized with Reverend Al Sharpton, the civil rights organization, the National Action Network. That was one of the ways. So I was out there meeting people and really trying to be a social justice activist as well as I could in secret without them knowing. I even got arrested for committing civil disobedience, and that was very hard, going to court three times and everything while working at the headquarters. Where is she gone? It was not easy. But then also knowing that there were things that I wanted to write about that weren't about aesthetic realism that I thought really needed attention. And there was a bookstore up in Harlem that was about to be shut down. And I created a pen name, Laura Douglas, and I wrote about it and a personal piece. And it got published in the store. A lot of people wrote in the store. Yay, it stayed open. But to my surprise, the New York Association of Black Journalists actually nominated the piece, and it won first place as personal commentary in an online publication.
Wow, that's really exciting. Congratulations.
And then I also met a couple of women not living in New York that I was able to go against everything that was ingrained in me, never say anything bad about aesthetic realism to anybody outside. Of course, you couldn't say anything to anyone inside either, or you'd be accused of having contempt, and your life might not be worth a plug nickel, you know, all the trouble you'd be in. But they helped me start thinking about whether this was the place I wanted to be. And they didn't start pushing me or, oh, that sounds like a horrible place, you've got to get out. But just having some people on the outside to help. And then the next thing, sort of like the final straw, was when I wrote about reparations for slavery. Now that, whoa.
What would the issue be?
I was told that the leader felt that this would make a lot of good people angry at aesthetic realism, good white people angry at aesthetic realism. I felt like the core values of aesthetic realism about economic justice, racial justice, and things that the teachings of aesthetic realism support that idea. And that was what I wanted to write about, the ethical reasons. I pretended like I didn't understand that she didn't want me to write about it. And I went ahead and wrote about it anyway and took the heat. And then I created another pen name, Marie Roberts, and kept writing about it under that. But by then it was like, wait a minute, it's very clear. The Aesthetic Realism Foundation and I have two totally separate agendas. They're all about winning more acolytes for Eli Segal and more followers of aesthetic realism, and I want to use my writing and my actions in my life to actually do good for people. And it's like, what's wrong with this picture here? I'm being forced under my own name to write propaganda for something I don't even believe in anymore. And I'm kind of embarrassed to even be associated with. And I have to use a pen name to write about the things that really matter to me. So that's when it's like, I can't stay.
Right. This is a visual probably that hasn't been ascribed to you yet, but I'm picturing you playing football right now. All these pen names you had to come up with, and the fibs, the omitting this, I'm going to do that. You wanted to get somewhere. It was important to you to write about certain things and to address it and to keep that bookstore alive and all of the things that matter to you. I'm picturing this opposing team coming after you with the big guys, and you're just in a really nice, squirrely way getting the ball around them and making a touchdown. I think that it's an incredible thing that you just found a way to still have some independence and some freedom, which is this human need that starts to come out after a while. And thank goodness it's there. I'm wondering just when you left, if they were trying to get you to come back in, if they let you be, or how that happened.
The whole element that we didn't cover today was that I was married to a man I loved. The thing was that I want to make it very clear, I was still gay. I was not sexually attracted to men as such, men plural. But I truly did love the specific individual for his human qualities who happened to be a male. He was in aesthetic realism. There's a lot to say about this. But that was really hard for me to think of leaving him. And I knew that, I think like most cults, once one spouse leaves, that's the end of the marriage. And I tried to get him to leave with me, and he tried to get me to stay with him, and we reached an impasse, and that was that. But I also, by the time I left, I was 53 years old, and I thought, how am I going to make a living? And I don't have any connections and hardly any money from working for poverty wages at the headquarters for almost 20 years. I won't even have anything to put on my resume. What will I do? The thing was, is that I was very fortunate that a person who had Caribbean Life newspaper, it was that the managing editor had always published just about everything I sent him. And when I called him and I said, I've left aesthetic realism, I've disavowed it, I'm done with it. And he said, well, come and write for us. He hired me as a staff writer, became a credentialed member of the New York Working Press. And that was the thing that started me off.
Wow. Wow. Incredible. I do want to invite you back to tell more of the story, because there's a lot left to be said. So this is an open invitation for there to be a part two. I'm wondering also just about this sort of irony that here you wanted to go into acting so badly that you were trying to fund it in ways that were difficult for your psyche. And what actually you're talking about now is being fully, truly yourself. And that's the thing that you get to do now and be now. It's not acting at all. You got to leave where you were acting, and now you get to be Donna, which is really quite powerful. So I hope you will come back.
I would love to come back and talk, because it's quite a story too, you know, about my conversion. I did not want to convert. Just how they convinced me and teaching conversion therapy, and then the fact that I did actually fall in love with a person. So there's a lot to say, but what you said about, I'm me, I'm really able to be myself and do the things that represent me now. And I also feel like, having been in a cult like that, so controlled, that where certain temptations that would try to have me sell myself out for something, it's like, been there, done that. Going to hold true to my principles. And it made me stronger in that way. But I really did come out and land on my feet. And then I love working with Holy Apostles Church. We have the largest soup kitchen and food pantry in New York State, one of the largest in America. I've been volunteering there for 25 years and working on behalf of immigrants and just doing so many different things that are really what give my life meaning through doing good for other people, which was what I wanted when I was a little girl.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, good. So we will make sure to get you a calendar of our times where we can record the next part of this, because yes, I want to hear all the things that you just mentioned, and I'm sure our listeners do too. They will sometimes be in touch with me when they feel like the time was short and we didn't get to hear the whole thing, and they'll say, but what happened next? So I'm sure a lot of people are going to be happy to know they get to hear more from you. Tell us where people can find your book and anything else that you've been working on.
The book is not yet available. It's a very long and winding road towards publication, but the working title is Reeled In, 32 Years in a New York City Cult. But meantime, right now, I do have a website at donnalamb.com, which also has a link where they can go straight to my Substack. They can go that way. And also the Substack is Cults Recruit People. And if I could just mention here at the end, one of the reasons it's named that, one of the things that you had said that I hadn't heard, I was still considering that, talking about why was I so stupid to get into a cult and then even more stupid to stay for 32 friggin' years. And then when you talked about why did you stay is the wrong question. It's what did they do to you that made you do that? And here I was like, my God, I've been out since 2001 and I'm still learning. And that was just like such a revelation to me. And it's like, I felt like in as much as I'm still blaming myself, I'm still under aesthetic realism mind control. What you said, it's always your fault and never its fault. And you just changed the different approach to looking at the same question. And it just did me a world of good. And just that thing alone, I was so grateful to hear on one of your podcasts. And you've talked about it on several, but it was just so illuminating.
Thank you. That's really lovely. And yes, I repeat it just in case anyone's listening for the first time. I want the focus to be off the person who is already carrying so much from their experience. They shouldn't carry responsibility and shame of staying because it's not on them. So thank you. Thank you so much. To be continued. It was lovely to talk to you. You're a really interesting person, really determined and wise and strong. And it's a total delight to get to know you.
Thank you. And it's been an absolute delight being interviewed by you.
One more thing before you go. My goodness. When you start talking to someone and you realize that even just talking to them for about an hour and a half is still just the tip of the iceberg, it's actually quite exciting to know you're going to be able to continue the conversation again. And I'm so glad you're going to be able to hear from Donna once more. And she is someone whose life has zigged and zagged, and she's taken us on these turns with her and in her telling of it, which is really an exciting example of someone emerging. And I love these stories. And so there's more. So definitely tune in to my continuation, my second episode with Donna. I want to come back to something that she talked about today, which was this idea that she was thinking and hoping, I think, that this group Aesthetic Realism was going to fix her. And I really was struck by this term, that it was going to fix her. There are many people who do feel that they need to be fixed, that there's something inherently broken about them. And that's not necessarily the case. There are people who have been through trauma, people who have been raised in certain ways that have left them feeling bad about themselves, or that they haven't had opportunities like other people have, or a whole host of things that cause people to feel like they are broken. But I would love to be able to have people not go into their adult life feeling that they need someone to fix them, because then, unfortunately, that's going to cause them to be dependent on people over and over again who they think are fixing them. Sometimes these interventions might be helpful, like with a therapist, someone who knows how to address some of the things, some of the pain, some of the damage. But it can also leave you open to people who say, yes, I have the answer for you. And they don't, but they love knowing that you're open to that. So I want to be able to today kind of shift this focus from defect to context. Like, instead of saying, what's wrong with me? You ask, what happened to me? Or what environment shaped this? Or what is wrong that happened to me? Not what is wrong with me. And sometimes if you think that you have a certain wiring that causes you to have difficulty in the world, yes, if nothing you think happened to you, it could be that still you don't need to go into the world feeling that you need to be fixed. You might need to be attended to. You might need to be able to have medication that you need or some kind of plan, a game plan, through a therapist or an occupational therapist, through someone who can guide you to know certain steps that you can take so that your life is an easier one. And so it is to help to adjust to the world around you in a way that feels like you're really fitting in a little bit better than before. But still, you don't have to walk around feeling broken. A lot of people born and raised in cults feel that way too. There's something just permanently broken about them. So if you understand that pain is not pathology, sometimes that can free you as well. If you can say, my loneliness, my grief, my confusion, my uncertainty are human states, not sign of brokenness, that would be really helpful. Controllers, though, pathologize normal experiences. Healthy systems normalize them, like, oh yeah, a lot of people feel that way, or it makes sense that you feel that way based on what you've gone through. But people who are trying to control you will say, aha, see, that means this is what's wrong with you, and you need to fix that, or I have the answer for you to fix that. It's also important to replace perfection with care. And what I mean by that is that many people don't need transformation as much as they might need sleep. They might need safety to know that where they're living is safe and secure, or that they have a place to live. They might need connection. They might need friendships, people who they feel they can relate to, people who they feel accept them unconditionally. They might need meaningful work because they are looking for meaning in these cultic groups or with these people, but really they might be able to get help just from doing something that matters to them. They can also be helped through having community. It's so important with people being so isolated to find a community of any sort that is healthy also, where you don't have to transform yourself to fit in, to belong, that they accept you for who you are. But also what can help you replace this perfection with care is setting boundaries. That if you learn or you learn that you are able to say no, or maybe later, I need to rest, or I don't feel comfortable doing that, then you know you can rely on yourself more to be in the world in a safer way. And all of these things help to regulate the nervous system, and they help the nervous system way more than all of these ideological programs or controlling partners. It's also good to see the distinction between growth and fixing. So healthy growth says you're already worth it. And if we have some things that might help you, yeah, we can add on to who you already are. Not that there's something inherently wrong with you from the inside that we need to build and we need to repair, but that you already are whole. You might feel damaged at times. You might feel confused at times. You might feel overwhelmed at times. But you already are worthy and worthy of being treated respectfully. And now let me help you and offer you ways that you want to develop that you think are helpful to you. Not ways that I think you need, but things that you think would be helpful to you. But a manipulative person or a manipulative system says, you are flawed, inherently flawed. And only we, or only I, can repair you. And then you want to be exposed to compassionate mirrors. Healing often comes from relationships that reflect dignity, capability, humanity. When people are in non-shaming relationships, the belief that they are defective gradually dissolves. It's important for survivors, people coming out of these situations, to be able to realize to a great degree, I was potentially not fully broken, and I was injured, I was misled, I was unsupported, I was neglected, I was potentially abused, but I am a whole person still that does need some tending to, and I'm going to make sure the people I invite into my world to tend to me are people who deserve that access to me. There are a lot of people who still walk around feeling like they need to be fixed, and I want to be able to let them know that this process of getting better and healing yourself is lifelong. But I want you to also believe in yourself that given the right circumstances, meaning healthy environments, safe environments, good people in your life, people who let you be you and don't need to change you and don't need to cure you and don't need to fix you, actually will give you a chance to see who you really are and all the strengths that you have and all the capabilities that you have. And then if there's more you want to work on, then sure, work on that. But if you want to come from that place of already feeling like, I think I have this. I'm not always so sure of myself, but I've survived a lot, which means a lot. I have a lot of internal strength. I have a lot that propels me forward in this world, or I wouldn't be here talking to you. Then come from that place of standing tall in your own shoes. And then you won't be so open to the next person who sees you as this fully wounded bird who they need to patch together and who they need to fix, and then who you need to feel somehow indebted to for fixing you. Take good care. I'll talk to you next week, and I look forward to having you here, part two of my conversation with Donna Lamb.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @IndoctrinationPodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Are you healing from manipulation, narcissistic abuse, or coercive control? I created something for you. It's called the Restore Journal app. Built from my decades of experience helping survivors recover, this trauma-informed app is more than journaling. It's a guided healing space to help you process what happened, reconnect with your voice, rebuild self-trust, and create healthier boundaries for the future. You can move at your own pace through all of the sections, and it's a multimedia healing support designed for different learning styles and needs. There are three tiers, including one that offers you full access to my video and audio library. If you're ready to feel understood, supported, and move forward with more clarity and strength, the link for the app is in the show notes. Take good care.